The art of songwriting.
I've always felt like lyrics are guided poetry. I feel like when I'm reading a poem on the page that you create your own sounds for it in your head. You might find your own rhythm reading it. But a song, the melody will push the meaning. So you can have a very simple lyric that on the page might lie a little flat. But a melody or the way someone sings that pushes the meaning into your brain.
And the emotion. Well, yeah.
That's Philip Price with Flora Reed, both of the band Winter Pills. We'll talk with them about songwriting and their new album, All My Lovely Goners. We also talk with Michael Timmons of Cowboy Junkies.
Usually it starts with an idea or a theme and then a little bit of music, and then that kind of feeds the lyrics, and the lyrics then feed the music, and it goes back and forth like that.
He'll talk about Cowboy Junkies' new album, The Wilderness. And our new associate producer, Drew Adamek, will be reviewing two books. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today, some rare musical treats. We examine the art of songwriting. Later in the show, we'll talk with Michael Timmons of the well-known Canadian band Cowboy Junkies. But first, we explore today's theme with two members of the Northampton, Massachusetts-based band Winter Pills, Philip Price and Flora Reed. The band has just released its fifth album, All My Lovely Goners. Of it, Price says, the songs were written slowly, arranged slowly, braised slowly in their own intentions, as mysterious as those were. The theme of the album is the idea that we're defined in many ways by the multiple wars we've all endured, as Price says, the broken hearts, traumas, and tragedies that shape our characters. Winter Pills' music has been labeled indie pop or chamber pop. What it is, above all, is rich, resonant, and emotionally powerful. The band has released four albums previous to their latest, including Tuxedo of Ashes, Central Chambers, and The Light Divides. The Washington Post called their songs densely packed but hugely evocative, tiny bombs of feeling and meaning. We'll explore that creative process of putting meaning and feeling into songs with Philip Price, who writes and sings the songs, and vocalist Flora Reed. Other members of the band include Dennis Cromit, Brian Akey, and Dave Hauer. Let's start out by hearing one song from the album, All My Lovely Goners. It's called Amazing Sky. Later, we'll hear our guests giving us a studio performance of another song from the album.
We took you down.
That was Amazing Sky off Winter Pills' new album, All My Lovely Goners. And now for our interview with band members Philip Price and Flora Reed. So, Winter Pills, first of all, you've been around since, is it right, 2005?
Yeah, well, 2004.
Maybe a little before, but...
But, yeah, first record came out 2005.
And had you been musicians before this, or is this your first...
Yes.
We had.
Separately.
So tell us a little bit about what you had done before, what brought you together.
I was, for 9 years, I was in a band called the Maggies, which was kind of a power pop band, I guess, in the vein of like the Posies or a little bit in the teenage fan club, big star area of things. And split up around 2002, and then I had a two-year period of solo stuff. I put out two solo records on a little New York label. And then Winter Pills started right in the late 2003, in early 2004. We came together in our guitarist Dennis's house where a bunch of us met. We'd all known each other from other walks of the local music scene. But we hadn't really played together a lot. But that winter was a kind of a formative winter.
And is that where the name? I mean, what is the name Winter Pills about?
Well, the name actually came about when I had a dream of an electronica project that was going to be called Winter Pills, and it never happened. It just was in my head, and so the name was an orphaned name.
And why Winter Pills?
I thought it's in my mind that I would like to go hear a band that had that name. That's pretty much the long and short of it. Little sort of not quite onomatopoeia, but like emotional onomatopoeia, I suppose.
And Flora, how about yourself?
I had put out one solo CD in, I guess, 2000, and had been touring around for it and kind of, I guess, realized that I didn't love touring by myself. So when Winter Pills came along, I was looking for other people to play with and sing with. So the timing was great. And I had known Philip's other band, the Maggies, and had been a fan of it. And
you actually almost were in that
band.
I
was almost in that band, yes. I did audition for that band.
But then we kind of broke up. So
so I could have known you even sooner.
True.
Musically. And I knew Dave Hauer, our drummer, from other local bands. And... So yeah, it was just a friendly connection.
The writing of lyrics, you know, the song "Amazing Sky." Do you want to just say what the lyrics are, or at least one or two stanzas?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want me to read them out loud?
Yeah.
To you?
Yeah.
Well, and I just want to say that, like, the lyrics for this song, perhaps in contrast to some of the others, you know, they're pretty simple. And when you read them on the page, it's like, we pulled you down, we took you down under the amazing sky. We laid you down on the green ground under the amazing sky. Did anybody ever tell you who you are?
So, yeah, these are simple. They're evocative. I'm not sure it's something like, I mean, there's something that says to me that this is not a poem. This is a song lyric, but I'm not sure what that is. Could you tell me?
I've always felt like lyrics are guided poetry. If you read poem on the page or you hear someone recite it, I feel like when I'm reading poem on the page that the author of the poem is really, there's a lot of room for, sometimes often a lot of room for interpretation, layers of meaning, and it's not always, you create your own sounds for it in your head. You might find your own rhythm reading it, but a song like the melody will push the meaning often. So you can have a very simple lyric that on the page might look lie a little flat, but a melody or the way someone sings that pushes the meaning into your brain.
And the emotion. Well, yeah.
So now comment on this song. What is the meaning of the song for you, and how did you connect the lyrics to the music? Even which came first?
I usually write melody first, and then the lyrics. I'll just sing kind of nonsense until the words fill themselves in. Or sometimes it'll just come out rather fully formed, though they'll happen together. This one, the melody did come first, but very specifically, the meaning of the song, well, it came out of a suicide of a friend of mine. And the image I had in my mind was, not to get too explicit, but he hung himself, and many people, I wasn't personally there, but many people I know took him down. Mm-hmm. And the act of taking down the body of someone that you love who has committed suicide was the central image in my mind when I wrote that. That it seemed so potent that I could just say it, and it would have enough meaning for me. Now, you know, whether something has a song or particular has meaning for me is kind of irrelevant to what it ends up doing in a listener's head.
Well, I'm going to come back to that, but I want to ask Flora first. So did you know this person as well?
I did, but not as well as Philip and his family. He was a really old family friend.
So when you learned this song, did you make a connection, an emotional connection to this person that you had known but not known as well as Phil? So it's almost like one step a little bit removed.
That's true. Well, this is actually the first time I've heard Philip say, talk about that image. So for me, what I was seeing when I would sing it was more, I guess, more the funeral, more the image of that, which is a little less disturbing than what you were talking about earlier.
Discovery of the body.
Yeah, it's a lot more.
And now, I listened to this song earlier. I loved it. I thought it was beautiful. But, of course, I had no idea what the story was behind it. Why is that not important when you're writing a lyric?
Like I said, I think it is to the songwriter. And it depends on the kind of songs you're writing, I suppose. There's certainly a whole vein of confessional songwriters or strictly narrative or balladeers or type songwriters that totally want you to know what the story is that they're telling. I've never been able to do that. That's never been my forte. I've tended to work in fragments of images and things that knock around in my head or in my notebooks, and I assemble them, and if they have an internal logic or sense in addition to the music, then that's how it all works for me. It's sort of collaging in a way.
So would you say that lyrics are more part of the music than something different than the music?
For me, they are, yeah. I mean, someone like, you know, Bob Dylan, you can like sit there and read his lyrics, mm-hmm. or you can listen to the music. You know, you have your options there. But I don't think that would necessarily work for me. I mean, I do write just poetry that doesn't have anything to do with, you know, songs per se, or I don't want to write a song from it. It's just its own thing. And it's a totally different part of my brain that I would use for that. Music tends to be, I keep mining the same places in myself for music. Whereas poetry, if I'm just writing poetry, I feel like I have a not a bigger palette, but it's a completely different palette of words that I would use even.
And before I ask Laura a question, I just want to follow up with you. What is that place that you mine for your lyrics?
Usually there's three or four places. there's some pretty swampy areas in me that are probably things in my past, experiences in my past, or things that didn't go so well. Usually misery. Miserable events tend to be very fertile ground for creative work. The happy moments, they don't need any help. So yeah, certainly those things in my past. But I mean, I don't like sit down and read a newspaper and go, "Oh, that's a good idea for a song." It tends to be like something along the lines of just a thought, like, "Oh."
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Philip Price and Flora Reed of the band Winter Pills about their new album, All My Lovely Goners. Philip Price is the songwriter and singer, and Flora Reed is the female vocalist. Well, I did notice there's a darkness in the lyrics of your of the songs on this album, and the music is so lyrical, to maybe use a pun. You know, the music is beautiful. The music takes you to a place that's very, you know, that's not really sad per se, but it is evocative. So, Flora, you are singing these.
Yeah.
Lyrics. Could you talk a little bit about how you make an emotional connection to the songs that helps you to carry them forward?
I would say the melody really does more to inform my connection with the song. I mean, I won't necessarily, you know, even just now, like not knowing the complete meaning behind the lyrics, I'm, you know, still able to bring myself emotionally into it, and that's what I feel like my job is, you know, in this band. There are songs where I sing lead on Handkerchiefs, being one of them, which is on an older record, but let's think about this record. The Sun Is Alone is when I sing, and Fleur de Luce, which is towards the end of the album.
Epic.
Philip says it's epic.
Well, the first one is really kind of spare and small, and then that one is like, seems epic to me.
Yeah, yeah. Fleur de Luce is a longer one. Bitter fields we bled on, slept then fled on. It's actually, this one I found more like a poem.
It's a little denser.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's more it's like I'm singing fragments of images, I think.
That one is actually, that's got the more literary connection of any of them on the album, just because I kind of stole the last couplet, I guess.
Hang the harps on trees again.
Yeah, that's from Hedwyn, the Welsh poet. It's not strictly, it's not a direct quote from him, but I kind of mushed the words around to fit in my phrasing a little bit. I don't know a lot about him, but I did read a famous poem that he wrote about you know, World War I and his experience there. And he does have a whole thing about, you know, hanging the harps on the trees and the blood mingles with the rain. It's the war song. I think I wrote one other in my entire life because I'm not, I feel like others will do it much better. I'm not a big, I don't know how to write a war song. I'm not very good with love songs either, I'm afraid.
Tell our listeners a little bit more about it.
The vision in my mind that I had with this was, well, it was connected to the... there's some songs on this whole album that are part of a song cycle that I wrote that was pretty well inspired by Currents at Owl Creek Bridge by Ambrose Bierce. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that story, which is a story I read, like, I think, in grammar school. And then I saw recently, or like in the past couple of years, I saw there's a French short film version of it. And it's all about, it takes place during the Civil War, and a man is being... I think a Confederate soldier is being hung on a bridge by the other army. And he's hung for a war crime, and the rope breaks, and he falls into the water, and he swims to safety, and he makes a trek across the lands, and he finds his home, and his wife is waiting there for him. And he lives like a whole lifetime, basically. And his wife greets him, and then the rope pulls taut, and he's actually dead, and all this took place in the split second before his death. And my original concept for the song cycle was that I would write a song cycle about someone, a soldier dying on a field who lived his entire life. So I could write so many songs that could fill in the narrative of his life, and it could be very impressionistic. I could do anything I wanted during that time. But the album would begin with his death and end with his death. It would begin and end with his death. Mm. So anyway, that song is a leftover from that song cycle, which I never quite, well, I sort of finished it, but I wasn't happy with it.
Are you happy with this song?
Yeah, I love this one. Yeah, we worked on it a lot, and I feel like this particular one is about, you know, crawling across the killing fields, like the Odyssean journey across the killing fields from a point of being wounded to a point of some kind of safety, which might be false.
Flora, do you have a favorite song on this album?
Ooh, I have a couple, and they've changed around a bit, but Pretty Girls is one of my favorites.
So tell us about that song. One.
You know, I'm not quite sure what it's about for Philip, but for me, it feels like it's about a relationship that had an amazing start, an amazing promise, and then something happened and it dissolved. So that's kind of my take on it. I don't know if, I mean, I'm sure that's in there somehow. But
that's one thread. I think that's one thread of it.
Yeah.
The other would be that the person singing and, you know, the character and the singing. And in my mind, make characters that sing things that I can't sing or I haven't really experienced. So I just make it up. Mm-hmm. But this character is in a state of great anxiety about his desires. And that's pretty much what
about his desires.
Yes.
Now you got me intrigued. You have to say more.
What are these desires?
Maybe we should just play it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Pretty girls just make me cry. Saw the skeleton of a bird fly by. It whistled through her bones. She didn't hear it. She was heading home. Pretty girls just make me sad. It was the best night that we ever had. Through the city streets we ran. Sometimes starfish move like human hands. Knew a woman at the farm. She was worried to her harm. She wanted me to watch her die. Waited patiently, but a bird flew by. Please forgive these bones, lightness of the air, heaviness of stones, the way I couldn't care. Pretty birds just make me cry. Saw the skeleton of a girl fly by. It whistled through her bones. She didn't hear it. She was heading home. She was heading home. She was heading home. She was heading.
Wow, that was beautiful. Just thank beautiful. You. Thank you. Philip Price and Flora Reed. Their new album is All My Lovely Goners. You can listen to it on their website. Go to Writer's Voice for a link. And for our Pioneer Valley listeners, Winter Pills will be playing this Friday, March 30th at Flywheel in East Hampton, Massachusetts, in a concert to benefit Planned Parenthood. For more information, call 413-320-9132. And now we have a treat for you. It's a new feature for our program, a book review, brought to you by our new associate producer, Drew Adamek. And first, a little bit about Drew. He is here with us right here in the studios. And first of all, I want to say, Drew, that I was really thrilled when I received your email out of the blue about a month ago, offering your talents to work with me on this program. You are a very accomplished writer. You're an investigative reporter. You have an impressive resume. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I started my career in Chicago with a series of civic watchdog groups that investigated government corruption and used the tools of investigative reporting to work with the media to expose that corruption. So I had an opportunity to work with a lot of different types of media, magazines, newspapers, television programs. And I used the skills that I learned there to transition into television documentaries and television news. And I spent 7 or 8 years working on television documentaries, true crime, current affairs, history, science documentaries for places like the Discovery Channel, National Geographic, and eventually got into international documentaries. But ultimately, I moved out of that when my wife became a grad student here at UMass, and I've been living in the Valley, and I had an opportunity to sit down and really think about what it was I was interested in and what it was I wanted to do with my career and with the skills that I've learned over time. And I realized that I just really love books. I love writing. I love the process of writing.
This
I
is
love
the song
talking to
Fleur
writers.
De Luce from Winterpeel's new album,
and
All My
do
Lovely Goners.
Fits perfectly with that idea and with that goal that I have to immerse myself in writing and to immerse myself in literature and books.
One of the things that I also love is that it really looks like you complement some of my own interests, because you're very interested in some genres that have unfortunately gotten short shrift on this show, and I'm really thrilled to have your voice fill out the gaps there. So talk a little bit about some of the kind of literature that you are interested in doing, in covering here.
There are several genres and types of literature that I'm really interested in. I'm really interested in short stories, particularly the science fiction short stories. I love speculative fiction, dystopian fiction. I love anything that sort of goes beyond the surface to look at and answer the question of why and how. Anything that really gets to the story behind the story, the causes, the effects of things that we see in front of us, maybe not even things that we don't even notice. So I'm very much interested in work and in fiction that explores the ripple effects of our modern life.
And those are exemplified by the two books that you're going to review for us. Just tell us the names of those books and who they're by.
This week I'm reviewing The Cyclist Conspiracy by Serbian author Svetlav Basara and Kingdom Come by J.G. Ballard.
That's great. We're coming up right now on a break, but Drew will be back after the break with his review of those two books. This is the song Fleur de Luce from Winterpeel's new album, All My Lovely Goners.
Bitter fields we bled on, slept and fled on, 60,000 leaves on freely, beds we killed on, spinning sightless, eyes like seashells crumble, came on, vapored honey, glow of water, brothers bathed in borrowed sheets, we always lived it till we'd given ruby filled in honey. Fleur de Luce, all my lovely goners, Fleur de Luce. is mingled with the rain. Hang the harps on trees again. The blood is mingled with the rain. Hang the harps on trees again. The blood is mingled with the rain.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Later on, we're going to hear an interview with Michael Timmins, songwriter for the Cowboy Junkies. But first, here's associate producer Drew Adamic with his review of The Cyclist Conspiracy by Serbian writer Svetlana Basara and Kingdom Come by J.G. Ballard.
The future is bleak for the human spirit. Conspiracies abound. The systems we've built to save us from savagery and solipsism have led us to ruin and collective dementia. Insanity rages. Mankind's only escape is a descent into further madness. Reality is an inescapable nightmare of boredom, madness, and oppression. Such are the dystopian and esoteric worlds of J.G. Ballard's Kingdom Come and Svetlana Basara's The Cyclist Conspiracy. These two international works of speculative fiction have just been published for the first time in the United States. Each offers a view into the unforeseen and devastating impacts that the imposition of unnatural structures, systems, and lifestyles have on the human spirit. Both use metaphorical dreams to weave complicated meditations on the spiritual, economic, and social ramifications of our modern lifestyles. One dream is of the sleeping variety, and the other a consumerist one, and each ends with a willing descent into madness. The Cyclist Conspiracy by Svetlana Basara was originally published in Serbia in 1988 and published in English translation for the first time this month by Open Letter Books. Basara is one of Serbia's most accomplished writers, publishing 20 novels and 13 short story collections. The novel traces the alleged history of the evangelical bicyclists of the Rose Cross found in a voluminous almanac of secret documents containing letters between famous historical figures, poetry, and architectural drawings. The evangelical bicyclists are a secret order that travels through members' dreams to accomplish three goals: the destruction of all systems, structures, and symbols that dilute direct contact with God, preventing the Tower of Babel's construction, and resurrecting the Byzantine Church. While the Cyclist Conspiracy doesn't have a traditional storyline, Basara creates a grand narrative of the struggle between the bicyclists and the spiritual corruption of iconography, authoritarianism, and moralism. Each chapter is a different fragment of the bicyclist canon spread out over hundreds of years. Each chapter is a different fragment of the bicyclist canon spread out over hundreds of years. Documents chronicle Sherlock Holmes' only unsolved case, attacks by ghostly Nazi stormtroopers, and architectural plans for a 20-million-person insane asylum. Basara expertly weaves these documentary fragments to create a novel of deep philosophical resonance, filled with allegory, symbolism, and metaphor. The book contemplates our collective spiritual, social, and political systems with a knowing, meditative voice that treats the reader as an inquisitive co-conspirator. The cyclist conspiracy is an enigma wrapped in a historical put-on, wrapped in esoteric in-jokes, wrapped in contradictions, all told with a knowing and skillful nod that fans of Robert Anton Wilson, Thomas Pynchon, and Jorge Luis Borges will appreciate. It's the best kind of novel in that it leads the reader to deeply consider one's own spiritual life without being pedantic or judgmental. This is a book that requires several deep readings and will likely yield new insights with each one. The Cyclist Conspiracy ends with plans for a humanity-wide insane asylum. The Metro Center of J.G. Ballard's Kingdom Come is that loony bin made shockingly real and horribly recognizable. Kingdom Come is Ballard's final book before his death in 2009. Originally published in the United Kingdom in 2006, it's just been published in the U.S. Ballard was long known for his dystopian, bleak fiction that comments on the crushing impact that modern life and technology has on the human spirit. He was a prolific writer who influenced a generation of cyberpunk and dystopian writers. Kingdom Come is a fitting capstone to Ballard's dissection of the madness of modern life. In it, Richard Pearson, a recently fired ad executive, travels to the London suburb of Brooklands to investigate his absentee father's death during a shooting rampage by a mental health patient at the Metro Center shopping mall. Pearson never knew his father in life and hopes to connect with him in death. But rather than finding closure with his father, Pearson quickly finds a conspiracy involving everyone he meets. The pillars of the community seem to have hatched a plot to destroy the Metro Center. The local doctor, barrister, police chief, and headmaster all seem to have played a role in his father's death in a misguided attempt to destroy the Metro Center. Pearson quickly gets subsumed into the conspiracy, unsure if he is a pawn or a principal actor. The Metro Center is a stand-in for the degradation of community that mass consumerism brings, the perfect symbol for town elders to target in an attempt to restore Brooklands to its former glory. But instead of devolving into a whodunit or a simple thriller, Ballard uses the plot as a starting point for commentary on the soft fascism of consumerism. The characters find themselves both magnetically attracted to and repulsed by the pull of Metro Center's consumer dreams. Nearly every character is pulled into a web of unintended consequences by their actions, each step causing ever graver damage to a widening circle of people. In the hands of a less skilled writer, using a shopping mall as the central motif for a criticism of consumerism could be trite. But Ballard leads the reader through the social breakdown caused by consumers' insane urges with believable ease. Not only does the reader believe that Pearson and Metro Center are descending into madness, but one can imagine it happening at the local mall at home. For Writer's Voice, I'm Drew Adamack.
That was Writer's Voice Associate Producer Drew Adamack. Next up, an interview with Michael Timmons of Cowboy Junkies about their new album, The Wilderness. Cowboy Junkies burst onto the Canadian alternative country blues folk rock scene in 1985. The group was formed in Toronto by three siblings, our guest songwriter and guitarist Michael Timmons, his sister, vocalist Margot, and brother, drummer Peter, along with Alan Anton, who's been replaced in recent years by multi-instrumentalist Jeff Bird. Their newest album, The Wilderness, is the fourth volume in the Nomad series, preceded by Renman Park, Demons, and Sing in My Meadow. Renman Park was a song cycle inspired by a three-month stay that Michael Timmons did with his family in China. Demons recorded the songs of the band's late friend, Vic Chestnut, and Sing in My Meadow is an album of acid blues about songs of sex and violence. The Wilderness, the latest release, is coming out this week. The title song was inspired by a book, Gilead, by Marilyn Robinson. It's called Angels in the Wilderness, and we'll hear it later. And here's my interview with Michael Timmons. Well, Michael Timmons, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you.
We don't have enough songwriters on this program, so I'm very glad that you agreed to come on. I was interested, my curiosity was piqued because of an album, The Wilderness, which is in the process of coming out. Is that right?
Yeah, it comes out officially, I think, at the end of March, but we released it through our website in the end of February. So, yeah.
Great. And you wrote this inspired by a book.
Well, sort of. The title track is very inspired by Marilyn Robinson's Gilead. And I guess there's a few other songs on the record which are inspired by that book as well. But it's not the whole album. My work is quite often inspired by authors, by the written word as well. So it's not unusual for me, but that song in particular, the title song, which is called Angels in the Wilderness, was very inspired by Gilead.
So tell us a little bit about that song and how that was inspired by that book.
Well, the album in general is about growing old and parenthood and sort of being lost in the wilderness of, I said, the wilderness of old age and the wilderness of parenthood, and fumbling your way through and trying to survive, basically. occasionally noticing the beautiful aspects of it as well, but generally you're kind of scrambling for survival. And the Gilead is a beautiful sort of almost a letter or a journal from an older parent to a son, and the parent happens to be a minister, so there's lots of biblical quotations in it, and it's a very reflective book, and it's got a beautiful tone to it, and there are just passages in there which I thought were they touched me very deeply as far as the way I think about my kids as well, and the title comes from basically a biblical quotation, but the protagonist of the book is saying that, you know, there comes a time when you have to throw your children into the wilderness, and you just have to have faith that there are angels out there to protect them. And that, I feel that's a very succinct and perfect way of describing parenthood and what happens when your kids get older, and you basically just kind of gotta let them go and hope for the best.
Yeah, it's actually a terrifying moment. I've been through it.
Yeah, I bet.
How old are your kids?
Well, my oldest is 14, so she's getting to that point. I can see her starting to pull away. My other two are 11 and 9, so they have a few years to go. But my 14-year-old, I think ever since she was one, she's been pulling away. So she's ready to go at any moment. So yeah.
It's interesting your phrase earlier that this album Wilderness is about old age and parenting. That struck me because I remember when I became a parent, I felt that I began to age for the first time, that there was something just about the process of being the older generation, even though I was quite young, I was only 30 at the mm-hmm. time, that did that. Is that for you as well, or are you really an older parent?
Well, I'm generally an older parent. I mean, I'm 52 and my oldest is 14, so I think in terms of the previous generation, I'm older. I'm probably more typical these days. But yeah, that sense of generation where you step up and you're the generation in charge. I think the other side to that is when your own parents die and then you're really the next in line. That's another sort of aging moment, I think. So yeah, I think I'm an older parent as well as being old. I'm feeling very old these days. I didn't feel particularly old when my kids came along, but certainly I think they slowly worn me down. So now I'm beginning to feel that.
How would you feel if we played a little bit from that song, Angels
sure,
in the
great.
Wilderness? Okay, hold on.
Are there angels in the wilderness? I don't know. About my doubts, but if you say so, but I got a feeling that we're doing okay. We did our part to make them bramble. Give you stone. does it, or will I leave it alone? And if it consoles you, will I take it away? Oh, hold my hand. Help me to understand. You break my
I hate to stop it there. That's such a beautiful song. And what strikes me is that one could interpret it as a lover talking to a lover as well as a parent talking to a child.
Yeah, I think people in general, when they hear it, they think in those terms. I think just because of the nature of songs in general are usually between two adults as opposed to a parent to a child. And, you know, the thing, too, is that there might be a verse in there as well, which is that, you know, my songs in general, they revolve around a theme, but I often break away from that theme to encompass other aspects of relationships as well. So, you know, I've decided there could be both sides to that. That could be the case as well in that song.
And you asked for bread and I gave you a stone?
Yeah, that's a sort of a biblical reference where you ask for bread and I give you. If you ask for bread, will I give you stone? Meaning, if you're asking me to feed you, will I reply with something which is completely inedible?
Yeah.
So it's sort of a sense of not giving you what you need or what you desire or what you want, really.
And that is, in some ways, sometimes a parent's dilemma, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of those questions in there. There's another aspect, another line in there, which is, again, inspired by something in Gilead, where it's basically the idea that you give your love to your children, and eventually they, in a way, hold it against you because there's almost a... They can't reciprocate, you know. The parent's love for the child is so great and so enormous that it's very difficult for there's no way for a child to give that back. So there becomes this sort of imbalance in the relationship in that way, and it turns often it turns to bitterness because, you know, the child begins to feel unworthy,
yeah.
You know, or is being forced to feel selfish or greedy. And there's a certain, I think at a certain age, I think it's usually in the teens, you know, the child kind of turns. And I think that's part of the reason why. There's just, and no matter what the child does, often the parent still can't help but, you know, continue to give them love. So it's a very kind of odd and unbalanced relationship.
So true. We're talking with Michael Timmins of the band Cowboy Junkies about songwriting and about the band's new album, The Wilderness. And also the sense of that I got in the song because of the music of it, also the longing, the nostalgia almost. Is that, am I just reading into it?
No. It's obviously supposed to be a very contemplative song. The singer or the narrator, it's basically just a series of questions, and the singer answers the questions, which is basically, I don't know. You know, so there's all these scenarios and all these possibilities, and ultimately, I think as any parent, as you quickly learn, you have no idea what the answers are. So, there is a certain melancholy to the song for sure.
Yeah. Now, this album, The Wilderness, is also the last in a trilogy of albums, each of which has a different theme. Could you talk about kind of this? Is there a narrative arc to these three? Is there any connection? Why are they a trilogy?
It's actually four.
Four, that's
four,
right.
Whatever you'd call that, a fourology.
a quadrology, maybe?
Yeah, there you go. when we set out to do these four records, the only thing that we determined was going to bind them together was time. And we decided we'd set a timeline for 18 months to write and record these four albums, each record having its own kind of specific theme, and whether it be a musical theme or a certain direction or concept. But the idea of linking the four of them together, there was no really conscious decision to link them. That was going to be too difficult and kind of get too tedious in a way. So not really. You know, as I say, there's a time element that links them together. And I think I would bet, and if you were talk to me in another year or year and a half, after I get a bit of distance on these records, I'll see something that links them together. Just because of the nature of how I write, and so writing in a very short period of time, 18 months, I know there are themes that will link them together, and ideas, and that will bind them. But again, there was no conscious effort to bind the four of them, except for that time frame.
And so, how do you write songs?
You know, it's really an isolated process. I have to sort of sequester myself away somewhere. I got to get out of my real life, and away from family and away from all other sorts of work, and get secluded a little bit, and then really just sort of go through ideas that I collect over the year or however long it's been since I've done it, and then do a lot of sort of self reflection, and then begin to sort of build songs. Not just lyrically and musically. Usually, the two feed each other. So the process, usually it starts with an idea or a theme, and then a little bit of music, and then that kind of feeds the lyrics, and the lyrics then feed the music, and it goes back and forth like that.
And do you feel that you have to, there are different traditions. There's the ballad, which is, the lyrics are pretty transparent. It doesn't feel like that's what you're writing more evocative lyrics.
Yeah, I mean, when I'm writing a song, unless, occasionally you're writing a song just for the fun of it, and you want a song to have a certain bounce or a flavor which is a little bit lighter or at least more fun, I guess, and then you're not trying to get too deep, you're just trying to put you're just trying to make it interesting on some level. But generally, I try and write fairly thoughtful lyrics. I mean, that's what I enjoy most, and that's what I enjoy doing. I enjoy writing songs in that way. So
contemplative, you mean?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean it's about looking inside and trying to figure out what's going on in one's life and in one's relationships and how one relates to the world at that point in one's life. So that's what I sort of do.
It kind of strikes me as something that a lot of novelists do, as opposed to, say, creative nonfiction or even just plain nonfiction. Writing a novel is about the psychological interior of the character. Mm-hmm. Do you have characters?
Yes, I do. I mean, and again, depending on the type of song, especially earlier, some of our earlier work, there was actually, named characters in my songs, and you could follow them through various songs. In the last 10 years or so, I've sort of gotten away from that style of writing. But as far as I'm concerned, there are characters. It's not necessarily always me. I might be taking an aspect of what I'm going through or looking at or reflecting on, and then building another the interior of another person in within the song. So it's not necessarily just a reflection of me. So I certainly look at a lot of these songs as being sung or about characters.
And your sister, Margot Timmins, is the singer here. Yeah. Are you writing for a female voice? Is that important for you?
Not really. I try not to do that when I'm writing. You know, very occasionally maybe, or yeah, there are times when I'm actually writing for a female voice just because I feel that the song is better represented that way, or what I'm trying to say is better represented by a female character, but not because it's going to be sung by a female. And Margot doesn't always flip the gender around either. She'll often sing as a male character, if you want. So, but I try not to think in terms of, well, this song is going to be sung by Margot, therefore it has to be written in a certain way, because that becomes a little bit, you begin to self-censor yourself a little bit that way, I think. I'm really writing for myself, and I'm not even thinking in terms of it of presenting it or it even becoming public in some ways. It's just sort of my way of self-medicating.
Self-medicating? Yeah. Say more.
It's my little psychological, treat to myself. And then those songs then eventually come out, and Margot takes them on and turns them into basically her songs in some ways. And it's kind of nice for me because it's a way for me to get some distance on them as well. Once Margot begins to sing them, they're kind of not my songs anymore in some weird way. So it's kind of a nice way. It's a very private, some of these songs are extremely private and very personal, but I have the luxury of not having to get up there on stage and sing them. I can pass them off and kind of get a bit of distance from them, which, I don't know, it's kind of nice in some ways.
That's so interesting because it occurred to me that in some way, the song goes through a kind of transformation. You write it, then the person who sings it makes it their own, and then the person who listens to it makes it their own.
Yeah, exactly right. That's very true. That's very true.
Well, Michael Timmons, thanks so much for talking with us about your new album coming out, being released in March and available
March
27th. Yep. The Wilderness, it's the fourth in the Nomad series. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
The Nomad series is available on the Cowboy Junkies website. Go to writersvoice.net for the link. Writer's Voice is produced by your host, that's me, Francesca Rhiannon, with the assistance of Drew Adamek. Our webmaster is Bill Way. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.